Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Romantics sang about how sleep brings out the unconscious in their 1983 hit, Talking in Your Sleep, and that was in a good way. But sleep talking and sleepwalking and many other sleep disorders plague millions of Americans every night. In fact, his own struggles with sleepwalking are what inspired journalist David Randall to take up the topic in his first book, Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. David is a senior reporter at Reuters and an adjunct professor of journalism at New York University. He's with us today by phone. Welcome to the show, David.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Question for our listeners. Do you suffer from a sleep disorder, and were you cured, or have you just found a way to live with it? Give us a call and tell us your story, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, David Randall, you were inspired by your own sleep order to write this book. What happened to you?
You could say that the topic almost literally hit me in the face. I started sleepwalking one night, and I walked into one of my hallway walls. So I woke up on my back about 2 in the morning, bad pain in my knee, and quickly figured out, hey, I need to go to the doctor. I don't want to have this happen again. So I went to the doctor, spent a night in the sleep lab, came back, and he said, you know what, I have to be honest with you. There's a lot we know about sleep, but there's a lot we don't know. So my best advice for you is to take it easy. So it almost felt like I had sleepwalked past the frontier. You know, it was beyond medical help. So I decided to find out, you know, if sleep was affecting me in this way, it's got to be affecting everybody else. And as I asked other people, nobody seemed to know anything about sleep. And that just seemed crazy. Here's this universal element of our lives, takes up a third of our lives, and yet how it was affecting all of us seemed to be this big mystery.
Well, why is that? Were researchers who are interested in sleep issues somehow ostracized, that this just wasn't important? What is it in our culture that made us sort of, a culture that loves to discover and study things, made us less interested in something like that?
Well, surprisingly, sleep is one of the youngest fields of science, considering, you know, we've been doing it since the dawn of humanity. Scientists only discovered rapid eye movement sleep, REM sleep, in the mid-1950s. Before this, most doctors thought that, you know, sleep was this unchanging condition for the brain, that once you fell asleep, that their responsibility to the patient was pretty much over. It was only when we realized that there are so many different cycles that the brain goes through while you're sleeping and so many different processes that it goes through that this might matter. So now scientists think that they're in the golden age of the field. There are over 75 different recognized sleep disorders now, and more discoveries seem to be coming every day. But at the same time, we don't know the basics about sleep in many ways. We don't know why we sleep. We know what happens when you don't sleep, but that doesn't necessarily answer the question of why we need to in the first place.
My guest is David Randall. He is the author of a new book. It's called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. If you have had problems with sleep in yourself, give us a call and tell us if you cured it or if you haven't, or maybe you've learned how to live with it. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet WOSU and All Sides. 75 disorders, more than 75 disorders. Do we even know if those disorders are modern or if they've been with us since the dawn of time or what?
That's a great question. It's hard to know for sure, but so many of these seem like they've been with us for a long time. There's just been no way to recognize them. One of them, one of the stranger ones, is called REM sleep behavior disorder. So when you're sleeping in your REM sleep, your body essentially paralyzes itself. This is why we don't act out our dreams. But for some people, this doesn't work like it's supposed to. So that's why you find, you know, people who are sleepwalking, who are running down the street naked in the middle of the night, or literally jumping out of windows, or putting their loved ones in a headlock. All these other things, they're acting out their dreams in a way they shouldn't. The reverse also happens, that you wake up when your body is paralyzed when you're not supposed to. In the Middle Ages, this was thought to be a sign that a demon called an incubus was sitting on your chest. But now we just know it's the brain's sleep cycle kind of having a wrong-footed step in the dance of what it's supposed to do every night.
Is that when you're half awake and half asleep and you want to call out, but all you can do is, you can't, no
exactly.
One can hear you?
Yeah, and people who experience this find it terrifying, you know, that they can't move, that they almost feel like they're trapped. And that's essentially what your body is supposed to do. You're just not supposed to be awake. You're not supposed to be aware of this time.
Some people just think of them as nightmares, and that's why it's sort of surprising that there has been research, if you will, or study into dreams for centuries, thousands of years.
There have. It's ever since, you know, we scratched out the first language, people have been trying to figure out what exactly dreams mean. You know, most of us, when we think of dreams, we kind of think of the Freudian idea of, you know, they're symbols and we're kind of telling ourselves these stories each night that matter to our subconscious. But now researchers think that perhaps there's something else going on. The two main theories now about dreams, one is that it gives us a chance to essentially have a dress rehearsal for whatever's going on the next day. So that's why you might, you know, if you're starting a new job, the night before you have a dream where everything seems to go wrong. It gives your brain a chance to kind of sort through all of this. The second is that maybe dreams are part of the process of how we learn. So, you know, every day when we're going through life, we pick up so much new information that at the end of the day when we're sleeping, sleep might be the time when our brain basically decides what we should keep and what we should throw away. So then as we're dreaming, the brain is frantically trying to make connections between this new information and what we've already learned. So that's why you might have all these random things from your past or from long-term memories, is because the brain is trying to find, you know, new connections, trying to find new patterns. And that's why now some researchers think that sleep and dreaming is so important to learning new skills, to coming up with new solutions to problems, to doing everything that basically to get ahead in life.
Of course, the irony there is so many of us go to sleep at night or go to bed at night, maybe not to sleep, go to bed hoping we can just give our brain a rest.
Exactly. We don't really realize that sleep is this really important time for the brain, and it's a time that we're away from kind of the everyday decision-making that we have to do. So there's this part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex, and it's right behind your forehead, basically. It's this massive wrinkles right behind your forehead. And, you know, it's aware every minute that you're at the day, part of the day. It's the only part of the brain that kind of has the ability to think about how you're thinking. Well, sleep, and especially deep sleep, seems to be the only time that also gives it a break. So, you know, we go to bed, we're mentally tired. By waking up the next day, we've kind of cleared the plate. We've kind of figured out what's important, what's not, and we're set for the next day.
I know about insomnia and sleepwalking and sleep talking and apnea, but I was really shocked to learn that those are just four of the more than, as you said, 75 sleep disorders. What are some of the other biggies?
Those are definitely the biggies. REM sleep behavior is another biggie.
What do you mean by that? I know it's rapid eye movement, but what do you mean by REM sleep behavior?
Oh, REM sleep behavior disorder. That's when you act out your dreams.
Okay.
Essentially, when when your body's not paralyzing itself like it should. That's why there's more and more cases where people claim to be sleepwalking at the time they committed what we think of as a crime. The most famous case was in the late 1980s in Toronto. A man drove 14 miles to his in-law's house, let himself in with his key, and then he stabbed his mother-in-law to death and almost killed his father-in-law. Then at the trial the next year, his attorneys and several sleep scientists convinced a jury that he had been sleepwalking the whole time, and he was acquitted, set free. And there have been more and more cases, and legal scholars now think, you know, the legal system, the courts, don't recognize enough that there's more shades of gray between conscious decisions and unconscious decisions, and that we need to update that to show that, you know, sleep is this kind of middle ground. But with the other biggies, there's different forms of sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us know of obstructive sleep apnea. That's when tends to happen. You know, sleep apnea, if you don't know, is your body essentially starts suffocating during the night. And you wake up, you know, this again for 2 or 3 seconds, and you go back to sleep. And this can happen 20 times an hour, all night long, without you realizing it. So you wake up groggy and always tired. For many people, this comes about because weight gain, basically. If you get excess fat in your neck, it's easier for you to essentially suffocate yourself. There's also central sleep apnea, which is less well known. And that's basically a flaw in the brain. The brain doesn't necessarily tell the body to to continue breathing. Then there are some disorders that are just truly strange. There's one called fatal familiar sleep disorder, which it's only been found in a handful of families around the world, but it essentially is it's a kind of cousin to mad cow disease, and its basic flaw is that you gradually lose the ability to fall asleep, but your mind remains clear the whole time. So, you know, people who have this go through months of chronic migraines, chronic exhaustion, and that's how, you know, the disease is kind of ripping apart their bodies in other ways. But then they, part of that too is they lose the ability to have restful, meaningful sleep.
Our sleep patterns have changed dramatically since before the industrial age, and research has shown that with the right circumstances, we would revert back to that pre-industrial pattern. What do we know about that? Is that the natural pattern, and what is that pattern?
So that's a great question. So many of us don't realize the effect of all the artificial light we see. You know, when you go to bed each night, you have your iPad, you have your TV, you have your lights, everything else. But our bodies are built for a world where the sun is the only bright thing that we see. You know, the sun pretty much runs the show. So, and this one researcher, a history professor at Virginia Tech, decided to kind of study the history of the night, and he found that there were so many references to first sleep and second sleep. And then he realized through his research that people used to go to bed around 10 o'clock or so, you know, after the sun went down, and would stay that way until about 1 or 2 in the morning. Then they wake up, and this was expected that they would wake up, and they'd stay awake for about an hour or so. And it was a very relaxed and restful time. Then they would go back to sleep. So this was the first and second sleep. Research around the same time showed that, you know, if we are sequestered from artificial light, we naturally go back into this pattern. It's almost as if this is the innate wiring of the brain. You know, the subjects in these studies, the first week or so without artificial light, they slept as much as they wanted, like kids in a candy store, you know, 14 hours a night. But after that, they started going back into this pattern of first and second sleep, like they were exercising a muscle they never knew they had. But what happens now is that so many of us don't realize that we're built to get up with the sun and kind of go back to sleep with the sun. And when we get off of this pattern, that's when, you know, health disorders can happen, when insomnia can happen, all these other kind of malignant effects will happen. And we also don't realize that, you know, the iPad screen you're looking at, that bluish white light, your body interprets that as sunlight because that's the only thing it's built for. So that makes it harder for you then to fall asleep later.
I've noticed when there's power outages and that sort of thing, I get drowsy, it seems like, earlier. Even though I can use a battery-powered light to read my Kindle or something like that.
That's probably something that happens to many of us. The light does just naturally keep us up. So if you have a battery-powered light, that light's probably not that bright.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in an office, the light there is probably bright enough to kind of get yourself off of this 24-hour cycle. So it's called our circadian rhythm, which is roughly a 24-hour cycle. It's a little bit longer, but roughly 24-hour clock that we naturally go by. You know, most of us, when we're not, after we get past the teenage years, we naturally, you know, wake up around 8 or 9 in the morning, naturally get tired around 2 in the afternoon, and it's not because you had a heavy lunch or anything else. It's just that's how your body's built to work. You know, in Spain and other places, mm-hmm. This is when the siesta is popular. Then you naturally get this kind of second burst of energy around 6, this takes you to 10 or 10:30, and then you go back, naturally want to go back to sleep. So if you don't have all these lights, if you don't have all these other things competing for your attention, TV, iPad, everything else, then it's very easy to fall back into this rhythm. And some people, you know, they get really excited by this idea of first and second sleep, and they decide to, you know, move to Montana and stay there for a month and see if they can experience it for themselves. And they do, and they find it very relaxing, and they like it.
My guest is David Randall. He's an author, senior reporter at Reuters, and adjunct professor at New York University. He's written a new book. It's called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, jobs numbers are bad. The Fed weighs juicing the American economy again. Should it do it now? We'll hear the arguments. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 63 degrees, a beautiful day today, sunshine, a high of 85. Clear skies tonight, a low of 61, more sunshine and a high of 84 on Thursday. Support for 89.7 comes from Westminster Thurber Retirement Community, hosting an information meeting for its new active adult residence in downtown Columbus, Goodale Landing, Monday, September 17th at 2 p.m. More information at 228-8888. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sleep and sleep disorders. We're also monitoring the story of the attacks on U.S. diplomats in Libya. President Obama is expected to address the nation in the next half hour. We hope to bring you those remarks live. Still with us, David Randall, author of a new book. It's called Dreamland, Adventures in a Strange Science of Sleep. If you have a sleep disorder, have it cured it, or have learned to live with it somehow, give us a call. Tell us your story, 614-292-8513. More than 43 million prescriptions for sleeping pills are written each year in the U.S., but they don't really work well after the first few months. I was surprised to hear about that. Why is that?
So many of us don't realize how sleeping pills are meant to work. To be fair, Ambien and Lunesta, the popular ones, generally are only supposed to be used for a week or two at a time, and people then take them chronically. But how these drugs work, part of the way they work is that they essentially give your brain short-term amnesia. So you take a pill at 10 o'clock or so, you then wake up at 6, you don't remember anything in between, you think, hey, I was sleeping soundly the whole time. Well, you might have been tossing and turning, you might have been moving around, you might have been up, and your brain simply wasn't capturing that into longer-term memory or short-term memory enough that when you wake up, you remember it. So that's why, you hear all these tales of, people have told me, one person in particular said, he went out into the kitchen the morning after he woke up, and his son was saying, Dad, you were acting so strange last night. And he said, oh, what are you talking about? I don't remember. And he said, yeah, you came out in the living room and your face was smeared with peanut butter. And you got down in front of the TV.
No one wants to do that in front of their kid.
Exactly. And like you're praying. And he had absolutely no memory of it. So it was all sleepwalking that he just didn't remember because of the sleeping pill Ambien that he was taking.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of stories about that. But you and I were talking earlier also about melatonin, which is at the heart of a lot of issues. In fact, it's the heart of the light issue and the artificial light. It affects the melatonin in your body.
Exactly. So melatonin is a hormone that essentially helps you fall asleep and stay asleep. It's basically, the nursery rhyme for your bloodstream. And the melatonin comes out. Your body naturally releases it as you get ready for bed, as the lights go down, basically. So that's why there have been studies that show that if you stay up all night or if you work swing shifts, you're working from 10 to 6, 10 at night till 6 in the morning, your body has lower levels of melatonin. And over the long run, this has been shown to cause many health problems. One study of nurses who worked the night shift for 30 years or so, they found that they had higher levels of breast cancer. Part of the reason, the theory was that their bodies weren't producing as much melatonin, and that was affecting their estrogen levels. But that's why, if you want to have a more natural way of helping yourself sleep, that's why, taking melatonin helps. It helps to take it earlier in the night than you think you need to. It's better not to take it right before you go to bed. It's better to take it a couple hours beforehand. It's better to do all these natural things. Watch your exposure to light. Watch your exposure to caffeine, which naturally keeps most of us awake. All these other things that can help, as opposed to kind of going the pharmaceutical route. Pharmaceuticals can help, obviously, in certain situations, but many of us don't realize the way that they're actually affecting us.
And alcohol is part of the problem as well.
Exactly. So you might, you know, have a glass of wine, and it makes you feel sleepy, and you go on to bed, and you think, oh, this is a great natural way. Well, what happens is that your body metabolizes that alcohol and then the sugars and it overnight. So then you do naturally wake back up. You might not remember it, too. So you don't go into these deeper stages of sleep. Many people don't realize that sleep isn't like jumping in the pool. You know, once you're in, you're wet, you're all the way there. It's more like you're bobbing up and down, so that all of us wake up several times during the night, you know, 10, 15, 20 times, but we're only waking up for a second or two, and we just don't remember it. So when you do drink alcohol or all these other things, when you wake back up, you're gonna have more of those times when you wake up, or when you do wake up, you're going to stay awake longer or long enough that you don't just immediately fall back asleep.
We have an email from John. He has 2 points. He says, I believe human growth hormone is produced during one stage of sleep. How long of a nap would you ordinarily need to take to get a shot of that during the day? Any thoughts about that?
I don't know exactly how long a nap you should take, but generally most hormones are released during deeper stages of sleep. So that, for most of us, takes 30 minutes or so. Research I looked at that just focused on naps said that the ideal time for a nap is between 30 minutes and an hour long. This is because it gives you that access to the deeper stages of sleep, which is not only helps us with hormones and kind of repairing our body, but also helps our brain, almost as importantly. Research from NASA has shown that astronauts who slept for about 30 minutes markedly improved their cognitive performance on important things like checking safety procedures and all these other decision-making things. But, you know, you don't want to spend more than an hour because that will affect your ability to fall asleep later.
Well, speaking of sleep and, you know, the lack of sleep and, you know, the astronauts, in reading about the military's interest in sleep, it made me wonder if it's a good idea to ask someone about their sleep habits when you're interviewing them for a job or something. Is that something you want to know?
That you might, actually. So researchers are realizing that so much of sleep isn't just repairing our body and making us feel well-rested. It really helps our decision-making ability, helps us solve problems, come up with creative solutions. And the military especially looks into this because soldiers do everything but sleep, you know, especially when they're in combat zones. So what they're focusing on now is ways to let soldiers take naps, get more sleep so that they're making better decisions. I went down to Walter Reed, which is the big research facility right outside of D.C., and I was talking with somebody in the military who studies sleep, and he showed me a graph that, you know, he was showing me that during the occupation of Iraq, that if a soldier was awake longer, he was more likely to get into an altercation with the civilian. So this was almost a self-defeating cycle. That, you know, you're staying awake harder and longer because you're trying to help the mission. But then by doing that, you are almost hurting the mission because you're creating more and more problems. That's another reason why companies like Google and Procter & Gamble and Nike, they're letting workers nap at work now. And the idea isn't to be, you know, we care so much about your well-being and we want you to be happy. I mean, that's part of it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But part of it is just self-interest. They realize that workers are going to make better decisions if they're well-rested. And if you're Google and you're competing with Apple and Facebook and everything else, your biggest asset is the brains of your employees. And you want the best decisions to come out of those brains. So you want them to be primed to make those best decisions. And sleep is a key, crucial part of that.
My guest is David Randall. He's the author of a new book. It's called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7. NPR News. Just to take that a step further, we know that kids do better in school when classes start later. We know they do better on testing and that sort of thing. And we know that, for instance, doctors shouldn't work those around-the-clock hours. You don't want air traffic controllers working those on hours. We want our pilots in our jets and on anyone to be getting enough sleep in between flights. Yet we persist in ignoring a lot of these things.
That's a great point. So much of it is we have this kind of cultural idea that I'll sleep when I'm dead. You know, I can say I don't need sleep. I can dose it with coffee. I can be this machine. And part of that comes from Thomas Edison, who, you know, perfected the light bulb. And he basically thought, for some reason that was never quite clear, that sleep was bad for you. you know, that if you slept for more than 7 hours, you were kind of going through this life in this haze, never fully awake, never fully asleep, and that all of us should be these 24-hour factories that can, you know, work at all hours with no downtime. And we've kind of taken that as a cultural thing. That's completely wrong. You know, the more sleep you have is generally better. You're going to make better decisions. You're going to be a healthier person. So much of teenage SAT scores isn't just the amount of sleep they're getting, but the circadian rhythm, too, which we talked about earlier. That your sleep cycle changes as you age. You know, that's why babies sleep all the time. And then as you get older, you find it harder to naturally fall asleep. For teenagers, their circadian rhythm, naturally, they'd wake up around 9 or 10 in the morning and go to sleep around 12, midnight or 2. But when the first bell rings at 7, it's brutal. It's not only just difficult, it's not just teenagers being lazy. It's biologically almost impossible for them to wake up early. So there's this one school district, a suburb outside of Minneapolis, and the late 90s, they moved their school bell back from about 7 a.m. to a little bit after 8 or 8:30. And there was a marked improvement in SAT scores, jumped by 15 or 20%. And it was such a big jump that the College Board, you know, the organization that runs the SAT, decided to investigate what was it that helped them out so much. And they couldn't point to anything but sleep. You know, kids were getting more sleep.
And when they were sleeping.
When they were sleeping, too. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't that they had to get up at this hour that was so difficult for them. So they're getting more total sleep, and they're able to wake up at a better time.
Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi. This is really interesting. First I want to say Edison never slept a lot, so he probably figured that if he didn't sleep a lot, then nobody else needed to. The other thing is that I have I get chronic migraines. From once or twice a month, and they make me. I always have the same dream that I'm being pushed underwater with my eyes closed, deep underwater with my eyes closed, or I'm driving with my eyes closed. Deep
oh
underwater.
My gosh!
And these go on for like hours, and the neurologist doesn't have any explanation for it, and I know that my parents have called, they've knocked on the door, it doesn't matter. Eventually, I will have to force myself to get up and take my medication. But after that, you know, it just takes me a while. And I am one of those people who cannot nap. If I nap, it throws everything off. Huh. I can't nap for 20 minutes because I want to sleep for an hour. And it throws everything off.
David Randall, any kind of cross-pollination between other disorders, migraines and sleep disorders?
That's a great question, and I get migraines too, so I feel your pain, definitely. With so much of migraine and sleep, it's so much of how the brain works, and you know, sleep scientists are still trying to figure this out. That's part of the reason, that's one of the downsides of having this one, a younger field of science. So much of the science isn't really settled yet. But kind of going to the issue of why you might dream about the same thing all the time, so much of our dreams are just our anxieties kind of writ large. So if you are driving with your eyes closed, it might be, you know, your brain just basically saying, you know, there's a pain in your face, there's a pain in your eye region. So you focus on that again and again. It's not that dreams have this deep underlying symbolism that we need a therapist to help us unpack. It's actually very kind of straightforward. If you have a pain in your head while you're awake, you're probably going to have a pain in your head while you're asleep too. We just kind of go in the cycle as a side effect of having this autobiographical memory and nothing else competing for attention when we're dreaming.
Thanks to Beth for that call. Interestingly, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but talk a little bit more about the issue of court cases involving sleepwalking have become more common. Is that because the problem is being diagnosed better, or that we do understand a little bit more about it, or is it because there's more people sleepwalking?
It's probably a combination of all of them. Researchers know so much more about this. They know that it's a real thing. You know, it's not just someone making this up and the jury being so willing to believe anything. You know, there have been people with some of these disorders. And so many of the people who then claim to be sleepwalking when they're committing a crime do have some disorder like REM sleep behavior disorder, which you, lets you act out your dreams and it makes you so you're not paralyzed. So there have been research, there have been cameras of them sleeping in a research lab, and you see them get up and do very complex behaviors, you know, singing, trying to move around, doing all these things that if you just looked at the camera, you thought you would think, oh, they're awake. But then at the same time, you look at their brain waves and you see they are definitely asleep. So there's a better recognition in the medical community of that. There's also a researcher at the University of Minnesota who studies this almost full time. So he's investigated more than 200 cases, and he's testified in more than 200 cases where somebody was claiming to be sleepwalking at the time they were committing a crime. And not all of them are murder, though there are several of them. You know, there was somebody in San Diego who was a fisherman who killed his girlfriend. He stabbed her to death. And he said he was dreaming of gutting a shark the whole time. He wasn't acquitted. He was put in jail. And then there was another famous case in Phoenix in the late 90s where somebody else stabbed his wife and said he was sleepwalking, and the jury didn't buy it, and he's in life in prison. So that's one of the things that legal scholars are kind of fascinated by, that here's this, there's almost no gray area. It's black or white. If somebody thinks you were sleepwalking, oh, you're completely free. Oh, we don't think you're sleepwalking. You're in jail for the rest of your life. And it's so hard to figure that out. And there are also kind of the other wrinkle is that if somebody was sleepwalking or claims they were sleepwalking, they might not even get to the legal system. That, you know, if you're sleeping next to somebody and while you're in the middle of sleep, you kind of throw your arm over and hit them in the nose and break their nose, that's just an accident. But if you're awake, that's assault. So there's no real record of how many times sleep leads to injury and what the effect of that is.
My guest is David Randall. We're talking about his new book. It's called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Teams Obama and Romney ride the bounce. Republicans pick a Democrat in California. Aiken nears another deadline to call it quits in Missouri. And a Maryland Democrat withdraws after charges that she voted in Florida as well. I'm Neil Conan. Our favorite political strategist joined political junkie Ken Rudin next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 64 degrees with sunshine, a high of 85 today. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 61. Mostly sunny for Thursday, a high of 84 degrees. Partly cloudy Thursday night and a low of 60. Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. More information is available online at themontgomerysolution.com. All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about sleep and sleep disorders with author David Randall. His new book is called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Joining us now is Dr. Lane Moore. He's the director of the Division of Neurophysiology at OSU's College of Medicine. He specializes in epilepsy and sleep medicine at the Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show, Dr. Moore.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
We've been talking about sleep disorders. It seems like a lot of any discussion about sleep involves disorders these days.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I often say to my patients, when I was a kid, we used to think sleep problems were kind of funny. And I think we realize now that not sleeping well has health consequences. And I think it's a measure of how we take it seriously now.
We know that the brain is as active asleep as when it is awake. How do we know that? How do we know more about the brain now and how it's operating when we're asleep?
Well, that's a great question. You know, a little over 100 years ago, a guy in Austria, Hans Berger, attached a single electrode to his son's head, a single channel, and recorded brain activity, and he called that alpha. And it wasn't too many years after that that people started to study brain activity while awake and asleep. And it turns out it's easier to look at brain activity when you're asleep because it's more synchronized. And so it looks higher in voltage. And so we study people sleeping with these electrodes on their head and look at their brain waves, and we can tell a great deal of activity is going on. So we can measure the electrical activity.
David Randall said earlier that scientists believe we're in a golden age of sleep research, and I was wondering if you agree, Dr. Moore, with that.
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, I'm trained in neurophysiology and epilepsy, but the areas in sleep seem to just be exploding. Absolutely.
614-2, as I mentioned, we are also monitoring developments in the attacks on U.S. diplomats in Libya. The attacks killed U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. President Obama is now speaking about the attacks. Here's the president.
Times they brave great danger. Yesterday, four of these extraordinary Americans were killed in an attack on our diplomatic post in Benghazi. Among those killed was our ambassador, Chris Stevens, as well as Foreign Service Officer Sean Smith. We are still notifying the families of the others who were killed. And today, the American people stand united in holding the families of the four Americans in our thoughts and in our prayers. The United States condemns in the strongest terms this outrageous and shocking attack. We're working with the government of Libya to secure our diplomats. I've also directed my administration to increase our security at diplomatic posts around the world. And make no mistake, we will work with the Libyan government to bring to justice the killers who attacked our people. Since our founding, the United States has been a nation that respects all faiths. We reject all efforts to denigrate the religious beliefs of others. But there is absolutely no justification to this type of senseless violence. None. The world must stand together to unequivocally reject these brutal acts. Already, many Libyans have joined us in doing so, and this attack will not break the bonds between the United States and Libya. Libyan security personnel fought back against the attackers alongside Americans. Libyans helped some of our diplomats find safety, and they carried Ambassador Stevens's body to the hospital, where we tragically learned that he had died. It's especially tragic that Chris Stevens died in Benghazi because it is a city that he helped to save. At the height of the Libyan revolution, Chris led our diplomatic post in Benghazi. With characteristic skill, courage, and resolve, he built partnerships with Libyan revolutionaries and helped them as they planned to build a new Libya. When the Gaddafi regime came to an end, Chris was there to serve as our ambassador to the new Libya, and he worked tirelessly to support this young democracy, and I think both Secretary Clinton and I relied deeply on his knowledge of the situation on the ground there. He was a role model to all who worked with him, and to the young diplomats who aspire to walk in his footsteps. Along with his colleagues, Chris died in a country that is still striving to emerge from the recent experience of war. Today, the loss of these four Americans is fresh, but our memories of them linger on. I have no doubt that their legacy will live on through the work that they did far from our shores and in the hearts of those who love them back home. Of course, yesterday was already a painful day for our nation as we marked the solemn memory of the 9/11 attacks. We mourned with the families who were lost on that day. I visited the graves of troops who made the ultimate sacrifice in Iraq and Afghanistan at the hallowed grounds of Arlington Cemetery, and had the opportunity to say thank you and visit some of our wounded warriors at Walter Reed. And then last night, we learned the news of this attack in Benghazi. As Americans, let us never, ever forget that our freedom is only sustained because there are people who are willing to fight for it, to stand up for it, and in some cases, lay down their lives for it. Our country is only as strong as the character of our people and the service of those, both civilian and military, who represent us around the globe. No acts of terror will ever shake the resolve of this great nation, alter that character, or eclipse the light of the values that we stand for. Today we mourn for more Americans who represent the very best of the United States of America. We will not waver in our commitment to see that justice is done for this terrible act, and make no mistake, justice will be done. But we also know that the lives these Americans led stand in stark contrast to those of their attackers. These four Americans stood up for freedom and human dignity. They should give every American great pride in the country that they served and the hope that our flag represents to people around the globe who also yearn to live in freedom and with dignity. We grieve with their families, but let us carry on their memory and let us continue their work of seeking a stronger America and a better world for all of our children. Thank you. May God bless the memory of those we lost, and may God bless the United States of America.
That was President Barack Obama speaking about yesterday's attacks at the U.S. Embassy and Consulate in Libya, attacks that killed U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three others. The president said that we are a country that respects all religions, but that there was no justification for these attacks. He also noted the irony that Chris Stevens, for him especially, Benghazi is a city that he helped to secure during the Libyan Revolution last year. And he recalled the memory of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. 89.7 NPR News will have continuing coverage of this story throughout the day. Okay. And welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Still with me, David Randall, author, senior reporter at Reuters, and an adjunct professor at New York University. We're talking about his new book, Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Also with us is Dr. Lane Moore. He's director of the Division of Neurophysiology for the Wexner Medical Center at Ohio State University. Getting back to sleep. Dr. Moore, what do we know about the effect of dreams? Do you agree with the when David Randall and I were talking earlier that dreams are just a way of working out what's coming up next in our life? Or are there is there more to it? And can dreams actually be a disorder?
Wow. First off, I don't know that anybody really knows for sure what dreams are. We see in psychiatrists and psychologists talk about how it helped us work through things. But some of the PhD neurophysiologists will point out that among the things that happen is pruning of memories and consolidating memories. And they're probably both right. I mean, there probably is some psychic drive to work through things. But among the things that happen is weak memories are pruned and stronger memories are solidified, and we're trying to understand, you know, how that happens. But suffice it to say that dreams are important. They're complex. They probably serve multiple purposes. And, you know, I couldn't argue with either side.
Ann in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Hi. I wanted to mention that people who have either been born without sight or have lost their sight and have no remaining light perception have major sleep issues. And there is a sleep study that's been going on now for a couple of years with Vanda Pharmaceuticals, the Ohio Sleep Medicine Institute here in Columbus, Dublin, and New Albany, have a study going on, and I've been involved in that. So they're using a very mild medication, Tazimeltin, to see if that will help people. So that that in itself has been really interesting. And then my other comment is about the dreams. And I lost my sight when I was 16, so it's been a lot of years now. And I have found One big change, and which is something I miss, is that I don't very often dream with visual memory, you know, images. However, I do know who were in the dream, so I always know who the people are talking. It's not that I hear their voices, but I mean, I always know who everybody is and what's going on. So it's just that part's very fascinating in and of itself.
That is interesting. Did that start as soon as you lost your...
No, initially, you know, I still dreamt in with vision and color, but over the years that has faded, unfortunately. And then the other thing that I wanted to comment on about dreams is that besides kind of sorting through the psychological aspects of one's life, I also find on occasion, it doesn't happen that often, but that I'm really in touch with a more universal aspect of myself, whether you want to call it your soul, but it's something larger than just our everyday life. Mm. And so those kind of things are very fascinating, too.
Dr. Moore, people who don't have, who are hard of sight, have hard time seeing or are blind, have you noticed any difference in the sleep patterns for them?
Well, it sort of depends on where the blindness is. So we talk about time givers or Zeitgebers that help us keep track of day and night. So there are really two ways that we keep track of time. One is you have an internal clock in the sort of deep part of your brain that really is a clock. It builds protein and breaks it down, and that's about a day circadian. That is, which means literally about a day. And then you have time givers or Zeitgebers, the German word for time givers, and the strongest one is light. Now, all of our internal clocks generally run about a little bit longer than 24 hours, 24 and a half hours. So if you put us in an environment where we don't have the cues, we will run longer. Longer than 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose sight in the anterior region, like your retina, and you don't have the cues going back to part of your brain that helps keep track of time, then your sleep may be altered. Absolutely. And, of course, anytime you have injury anywhere to the top of the brain, the neo meaning new cortex, that can alter your sleep patterns as well.
Thank you, Ian, for that call. We appreciate it. David Randall, you wrote about bed sharing and the issue of bed sharing and sleep problems.
Yeah, that's it's getting to be a bigger issue. So many of us, you know, a generation ago, many people thought, you know, putting baby in crib at night, kind of move away from them, that's the standard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now so many people are deciding to share the bed. Some people, you know, actually literally have the child in the bed with them. Some have a bassinet right next to them, and kind of that's basically connected to the bed. And this is starting to the issue is not only sleep but parenting. Does this help or not? Do people sleep like this around the world? And some research I found from Dr. Jody Mandel, who's at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. She's one of the few people who have studied sleep habits around the world, and she discovered that, you know, the average bedtime in places like China or Australia or the U.S. is vastly different, and the sleep habits are vastly different, too. In many Asian countries, co-sleeping is common, and it's not as common in the U.S.
Dr. Moore, when you're talking with a patient, I mean, how much do these kinds of daily habits, these daily behaviors come into conversation?
Well, I try to make them come into conversation every time that I visit with them, because mm-hmm. those are all things that can affect sleep. And sometimes someone in the bed can improve sleep, but frequently it will impair sleep. And it doesn't even have to be a person. Pets are often a 30 or 40% of us sleep with pets in the bed, too. So if somebody isn't sleeping well, we have to ask about those sorts of things. And so I try to ask about it, you know, with every patient visit, because it certainly can be very important. And I don't think patients, maybe any of us, think about that until someone asks us about it.
And we talked earlier, we're running out of time, but that more than 43 million prescriptions for sleeping pills are written each year in the U.S. How much do sleeping pills and that kind of thing come into play in your practice?
Well, I think it would come into play a lot if I gave it out.
Okay.
As often as it's asked for. You know, none of us like to be sleepy. I can tell you that I've been sleep deprived much of my life, usually because of a pager. Mm-hmm. So being sleepy is no fun. And if a pill will solve the problem, you know, it would be human nature to want to get that pill immediately. The problem is your body gets used to it. So the medication binds to receptors. Well, your body says, hey, there's more of that neurotransmitter. I'm going to make fewer of those receptors. And then eventually doesn't work as well. So although they're asked for a lot, I think most sleep doctors probably don't use them as often as they're asked for, and we usually try to find other things before bedtime to try to get the person's own natural rhythms to make them sleepy. But even at that, they're very, very commonly used. And your point.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Moore.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lane Moore, Director of the Division of Neurophysiology for the Wexner Medical Center at Ohio State University, and also David Randall. David, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
David's the author of a new book. It's called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.